sometimes behave so strangely.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. Today, we're going to be getting into not the construction or the explanation of music, but how to take it apart. Tim DeRoos, who's a PhD candidate at the Department of Music Research at McGill University, is bringing us a recommendation for Unmixer, an interface for extracting and remixing loops by Jordan Smith, Yuta Kawasaki, and Masataka Goto. This is work that Jordan undertook while visiting the National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology in Japan. And he's here as well to talk us through what exactly this interface slash research tool slash fun thing to play with is that he made with his collaborators. Dr. Smith is a research scientist that's recently joined TikTok and has been a researcher in a bunch of different places. Jordan, you've been kind of all over, haven't you?
Yeah, I started my PhD in Los Angeles and halfway through moved to a different lab in London. And then I had postdocs in Japan and in France. And well, now I'm back in London.
And Tim, you're at McGill now. Did you also do your master's at McGill?
Yeah, I did my master's at McGill in the music technology area. Mostly look at repetition and repeated patterns in music, mostly symbolic music. So the topic today, which is mostly audio, is something that I'm very excited about, but I'm mostly a dabbler in.
All right. Yeah. Do you want to take us through what this project is about?
Music is repetitious. No citation needed. But a lot of music, especially, say, you know, dance music or electronic music nowadays, or since, you know, since the 90s, since the 80s, since people have been making music on computers, has a steady tempo, and it's composed of loops, right? It's composed of here's a bass loop, here's a drum loop, here's a synth loop, and these loops can kind of come in and out and such. But what Unmixer is it's a tool that can decompose an audio track into its component loops. And it does that using, kind of building off of existing techniques for source separation, that is separating a combined audio stream into, you know, what things were added together to make it, you know, the drums, the synth, the bass, the vocals, etc. So it kind of builds off of that, but it adds this structural information that if you know, or if you at least assume that this music is made of loops that repeat, you can use that kind of redundancy that you're assuming is in the data in order to do the separation better. And what really excited me about this, you know, when I saw this paper at Izmir last November, I just kind of stared at it like, this is incredible that this works this well, and also the kind of logic behind what works is so appealing and elegant, and it's so interpretable that I just immediately went and looked up all the math on it. So yeah, it's a source separation method that uses the redundancy of musical repetition in a very cool and intuitive way.
Well, thank you.
I love that you call it redundancy.
Well, look, I stare at data all day. I'm staring at MIDI and like I'm staring at music as if it's just a bunch of dots in two-dimensional space.
Right.
So redundancy is is how I almost have to think of it, right?
Yeah. Is that how you also think about it, Jordan, as leveraging redundancy in musical tracks or musical pieces?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a good description of the paper, I think. It's all about assuming that there's going to be a lot of metrical redundancy in the piece, meaning that the same content in a piece is going to repeat it again and again, not just in time, but with a specific period. And generally for this method, or for this website, we just analyze it at the one bar level. We look at all the content that repeats bar after bar, but you could do the same thing with a two bar timescale or with a half bar or with a one beat timescale. And the choice of it is really just a design choice, like what is going to make the website easiest to use and jump into and get going with. And also, you know, you can use it at any timescale, but you have to have reliable estimates of where the downbeats are for that timescale. If you were source separating all the beats, then you can be very confident with lots of methods that you've got the right beat positions. With downbeats, it feels like it's only been recently that downbeat tracking is close to solved. Certainly for, you know, the kind of 4/4 dance music that Unmixer is best with. But then when you get into the two bar periods and four bar periods, where the downbeats are is less easy to estimate.
Because it's hard to explain this at a distance, maybe we should go and actually play with this web interface that you've designed. So Jordan, take it away.
Okay, sure. So you are the user, you've come to a web page, and there's a big box that says drag and drop a audio file in here to extract the loops. And so you do, and if it's a song it has seen before, it will give you an answer pretty quickly, but otherwise it will take, you know, 5 or 6 minutes to process the audio file and extract source-separated versions of the 10 most common loops in the piece. And then you can click on any of them to activate it. So here we've loaded up. Is it okay that I've got copyrighted music here? I think this is going to be fine?
Yeah, it's fine. This is for research purposes. It's all okay.
All right, it's research. I've put in Martin Solveig's song Hello. It's at 128 BPM, so I'll just change the BPM. Okay, so the first loop is this. It's just the main kick, and if we add the next loop, it'll be this. Mm-hmm. That's the third one. And maybe it's hard to hear with the mix, so let's just go back. So this is the third loop. This is the fourth one. The fifth one. And then the sixth and the seventh are sort of like two halves of one sound. So this is the sixth. It's the beginning of the hello, and we can add it. Six and seven. And I'll just play around with it, sort of adding different sounds. And then we can add in some sounds from a different song. So this is Doing It Right by Daft Punk. So it's a different kick drum sound.
Yeah.
This is interesting. It's not pitch match. So it's stretching everything to have the same length, but it's not trying to make them sound good in terms of a mashup. Just adding drum loops from other songs, like, there's some Creative Commons music that we let you start off with. You can hear Praise You in there.
It's really cool how it separates some things, and then there's other stuff that's like ends up being more of a mix. So can you give us some examples of the like fuzzy combinations?
Some of the weird ones where you hear the artifacts, those are actually some of the most interesting sometimes. Yeah.
So the output of the algorithm, you don't always hear terrible artifacts. What you're more likely to hear are sources that are just not correctly separated. So if we listen to all the different sounds in Doing It Right, we should be hearing lots of the same kick and clap sounds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there.
Yeah.
So there's like a little bit of percussion coming through that, but it's also like pretty clearly separate.
In the set of loops that it extracts for this song, there are just the kick sounds, and you'd think that all the kick content should have been drawn out into one sample, but it doesn't successfully do that. Here, let me see if I can find a good example of that.
Oh, that's nice.
That's interesting.
I like that.
That's another. You can still kind of clearly hear the percussion in the background of that. There's two samples in here that have this like the big aftermath of an initial downbeat kick. Mm-hmm. That's one.
Oh, that sounds cool too. This is, yeah. So, like, you can hear sometimes it's like a mixture of what the producer would think of as separate tracks, but it also has like a distinct character. To me, it's like interesting to hear those examples because they sound good together.
If you're listening to this and you heard, you know, that just playing with that, this is such a kind of infectious tool to play with. Sometimes because mm-hmm. of those the ways in which it separates things in ways you wouldn't expect, and you can recombine mm-hmm. and kind of like recontextualize sounds from a song that you're really familiar with, and it just like, oh, this has half of the kick, you know, this has like part of the kick, but it doesn't have like the lower range of the kick, and this has part of the vocals, not the lower range of the vocals. Mm-hmm. I think you talk about in the paper itself, there are problems when see, there are two loops that maybe a producer would think of as separate loops, but they almost always occur at the same time, or they almost always occur together. Right. And you introduce like, you know, sparsity constraints in that to like try to enforce their separation. But to hear how it behaves when it's trying to separate things that always occur together, you get these kind of half separations or these little mixtures that, I mean, obviously this is not like you were trying to avoid this in the paper, but this is something that in some ways, like as a creative tool, makes it really, really fascinating. Also, where it succeeds and where it fails is just like, mm-hmm. I was playing with it yesterday in preparation for this, and I was just like, I knew I should probably go to bed, but I was like, oh, I want to add one more track just to see what I can do with it, just to see what happens.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I've had an interesting sort of dual experience in showing this to mm-hmm. other people. When I've shown people in my field, the reaction has been really positive and they're very impressed with the quality of the separation. Mm-hmm. And then when I've shown it to my friends and family, they kind of just get their eyes glaze over a little bit. Partly maybe because I'm, you know, trying to explain things in too technical a way, but I think maybe it's because they don't anticipate how hard it typically is to do blind source separation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't even work in this field, and I get relatives and friends asking me, hey, is there a tool that just does source separation? Like people, it's one of those things that people who aren't in the music business is kind of expect, oh, this must be solved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Obviously, just from what I know about it, the degree to which it can, especially when you have something that's the tempo is really soft and there's no like vocals or anything, the degree to which the source separation does work is really astounding, especially mm-hmm. considering the kind of huge variety of different timbres. Like, it's not optimized for piano or something. It's not like one of those things that's optimized for a specific genre, a specific timbre, right? It's just like mm-hmm. it's using the mm-hmm. redundancy, which is, that is really cool to me. But also from the artistic standpoint, right?
So one thing also to say, you were both asking for examples with audio artifacts, and I couldn't find any. I hope that's not just me being, you know, trying to show you the best face of it. What I think the cause for that is, you can imagine two ways of trying to do source separation on a signal. One would be to mm-hmm. reconstruct all the different components of the audio that you expect belongs to a source, and then synthesizing that. And the other would be to just take the original spectrum of the sound and sort of black out the parts that you're pretty sure don't belong to the source.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right.
You know, mask out the parts of the spectrum that you think are the interference and just leave the remainder and hope that that's your source. It's that second method that we do.
Okay, interesting.
So that's why it tends to sound pretty good.
Yeah.
And it will sacrifice isolation for a good soundingness.
Yeah.
Right.
And you can sort of turn up the strength of that masking to attempt to get a stronger separation, potentially at the expense of more artifacts. But we haven't turned it up very high, mm-hmm. so to speak.
That's interesting. So that's why, for example, in the vocals of Doing It Right, you'll hear the kick drum in the background because you're not really pushing the separation amount. You're trying to just kind of maintain coherence, like make sure the vocals are all there. Don't try to push it to the point where you start losing some of the vocals as well.
That kind exactly.
of, okay, yeah.
Jordan, where did this project come from?
So this project idea is actually the realization of a long-held dream of mine, which is part of why it's been a really exciting project for me. For the last, you know, decade, say, of working in music information retrieval, almost all my work has related to music structure analysis. But before mm-hmm. I got into the field, you know, back in college, I was getting into composition and a little bit into audio production, and I was getting interested in making mashups. Mm. I really liked that genre, and it was, you know, early 2000s, so it was early days of sharing mashups online. Mm-hmm. And then eventually Girl Talk came out, and yeah. that was a really exciting kind of like hyper mashup. The problem with making mashups at home on your computer when you're too cheap to actually buy a digital audio workstation that does lots of this work for you is that you have to spend a lot of time listening to your songs and opening up applications to cut out the excerpts that you want to reuse. And, you know, you have to listen to the whole song to find the part of the song where the bass is most isolated or where there's mm-hmm. the drum break. And so finding all the interesting reusable samples in your audio library is really tedious. And mm-hmm. I always wanted to make lots of mashups, but I kind of never got around to it because I was too lazy to do this thing. Anyway, so I always had this idea that...
So you tried to do source separation instead?
Well, so another thing is later on, I learned of this website. There might be a zillion things like it, but it's called The Adventure Machine. And it's this promo website for the electronic artist Medeon, where you just sort of click on the buttons and you trigger samples. And it's the interface is populated with all the source loops of the song. And then you get to just make a live mix of it and play mm-hmm. around with it and explore the song. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is great, but wouldn't it be great if you could upload a song and the website would pick it apart and populate this interface for you? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was about 5 years ago. And I always wanted to work on this when I was at AIST. And in my last year of working there, that's when we worked on the non-negative tensor factorization algorithm. That is, you know, the core algorithm for the website. Mm-hmm.
For the actual separation of tracks. Now, so part of this was inside AIST. And as I understand it, AIST is... Oh, it's a research institute. It's not a university setting. So is it
Correct.
All of this like open, or is part of this under their sort of like intellectual property or like?
Yeah, it's a bit of a hybrid in that sense. It's kind of funny to work at AIST because there we are in Mastaka Goto's lab. And we're all working mm-hmm. on music or media stuff. But our neighbors across the street within the AIST complex might be working on solar cell technology or robotics or, mm-hmm. you know. So AIST has a lot of protocols or policies that try to prevent researchers from creating extremely valuable inventions and then not patenting them or not mm-hmm. Taking advantage of the value that could be gotten out of it. Mm-hmm. But we're all researchers and mostly we make stuff and do experiments to publish research. And once you've published something, it's public, right? And there's no reason to protect that anymore. But it's still, the IP, I guess, is still technically owned by AIST.
Right. So some of what you've created, like some of that code may be on GitHub somewhere, but a section of it is still reserved and separate. Like the website is still based off of their servers that's separate and you like that it isn't completely open.
So I have published a version of the non-negative tensor factorization code mm-hmm. on GitHub.
Okay.
But I wasn't able to do that while I was at AIST. I think there's procedures you can go through to get authorization to make your research totally open or public. But you have to go through a lot of steps and make a case for it.
Right.
In this case, the way we justify it is that, you know, we invented a procedure, let's say. We published it at ICASP mm-hmm. In early 2018. Mm-hmm. And now I don't work there anymore. And I have rewritten the code. So mm-hmm. I've only done something that anyone could do by reading the paper mm-hmm. and figuring out the steps you need to code.
Cool.
And actually, I think I've made it a little bit better now.
All right. So if someone is interested in the like re-implementing or playing around with some of the elements of what we'll be discussing in more detail, they can mm-hmm. access sort of the main components of that algorithm through code that you have shared.
Yeah, yeah. In practice, it's open at this point.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get into how this actually works.
I I want to say, if Jordan, you agree, I think it makes sense to approach it from like a development from non-negative matrix factorization in general, like how it's usually used for source separation, just on a very, in the two-dimensional case, figuring out kind of the frequency profile of each note, and then figure out where that frequency profile happens in time. Because that's how I saw it. It's kind of a natural extension of a lot of techniques that are kind of, I guess at this point, like canonical almost in source separation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I see there as being sort of two ways to explain it. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, so you have non-negative factorization techniques that are useful for lots of things, including source separation. And if you want to do it for source separation, there's lots of clever variations of NMF that you can do. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of parallel explanation in the kernel additive modeling world, median filtering world. So are you both familiar with the Rapet algorithm?
No, go ahead and explain.
I don't think so.
But so the Rapet algorithm was proposed by people in Brian Pardo's lab. Zafar Rafi, I believe, is the first author. He has a very clever way of doing foreground-background source separation. The idea being, the foreground will be the through-composed, non-repeating part of the signal, and the background will be whatever is constantly repeating in the signal.
So if we're thinking of a hip-hop track, there'll be like a sample that repeats a lot, and then there'll be all of the different action of like the rap on top of it or something else. And so you should be able to find consistency at one time scale that will reflect the background, and inconsistency at another time scale that will be what people are maybe hearing or would recognize as iconic or as melodic.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And it, as you said, it would work best in a genre like rap or hip hop, where you've got a sample that repeats a lot in the background, and it's almost on par in terms of content with the rest of it. Another song that had lots of samples that were shifting around a lot and lots of different sounds, like Starships by Nicki Minaj, say, where there's, you know, all sorts of different sections in the song, it might not work in an example like that.
Would it struggle to manage something that was like very repetitive but was, let's say, played live rather than have an exact repetition of a recording? Would that make a big difference in terms of the quality of extraction?
It should. For the original Rapet algorithm, the first few steps of the way it worked were very similar to how the Unmixer algorithm works, where you take a signal, the spectrogram of the signal, you chop it up into downbeat-sized windows, effectively. And then you stack them in a third new dimension, and then you take the median across that dimension. So that way, if there's anything that is repeating more often than not at the same time, that content will be part of this median image. And anything that is often changing, parts of the spectrum that are often changing, will just be, the median will be zero because they'll generally be inactive.
So by chopping the song up into bars and stacking them and taking the median, you're kind of constructing the median bar. You're kind of making a prototypical bar by doing this this operation kind of vertically across this new dimension.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, that's that's really
and
cool.
And then you sort of presume that this is the background content of every bar.
Yeah.
And you attempt to do the separation in that sense. And so that was, so even though my method is in the factorization family of methods, the conceptualization of it came from thinking about this and taking the signal and stacking, you know, the one bar sized windows in a new dimension. But then instead of collapsing it and taking the median, just imagining this as a 3D volume and how to approach that.
That's fascinating, because after I saw the paper at Izmir that evening, I was going on and looking at this type of factorization you were using. And I knew enough linear algebra and such to understand the math. And I thought, okay, that makes sense that it works. But looking at the math itself and how you're taking this kind of three-dimensional volume and factoring it out into these loop templates, I thought, I would never have seen from if I just knew about this factorization technique. I don't think I would have ever realized just from that that it had this application where it could factor these things out. So knowing that you got it from this stacking idea, from this other also very kind of neat method by which you're getting this foreground background separation, the RPET algorithm, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a really cool kind of line of research that the research kind of was inspired in that direction. That's a nice
story, definitely. You know? Yeah. It was definitely came from playing around with the spectrum and thinking about what I wanted to do with it and what I thought should be possible. And then from there, Googling around tensor factorization, volume analysis. I'm sure I was looking up lots of other incorrect words before. You know, I was probably looking up 3D matrix factorization or something.
Right.
And then eventually discovering this technique that seemed to be very appropriate to the task and also had a open research implementation. Well, it had a Python package implementation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We should all praise Python. And the way in which we share, the way in which we share implementations, that's, yeah.
Praise,
fantastic.
Praise Librosa, praise, praise various.
Definitely.
And now in the initial conception of this RPET system, there's a foreground and a background, but obviously what you're doing is a lot more complicated. There's a hierarchy of track components. There's a separation into many different pieces. And I'm sure that that's where a lot of then the discretion is exerted in defining how this algorithm should work.
Well, just to be fair, I should add that there are extended versions or, you know, more advanced versions of RPET that look for content in the spectrum that might be part of the median or might be worth filtering out in this median way, but that aren't exactly in this periodic grid. Hmm. And I think that's where the improvement of the algorithm was focused on. But if you were trying to extract multiple types of bar and they might be overlapping with each other, it's hard to imagine how you would extend this median filtering approach because you'd have to have some sort of clustering approach. So for the way I was thinking about the problem, it made more sense to factorize the volume, which basically just means find column vectors in any dimension that repeat often, kind of like finding the eigenvectors of the volume, but in any dimension.
How are you prioritizing which vectors are shared? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I think the first thing to say about this problem is that, as with any factorization technique, you have to pick the number of templates that you're going to find. So if I say, dear algorithm, please factorize this volume in terms of sound, rhythm, and loop activation templates, I need to tell it how many of each template are going to exist. So it finds the optimal way of compressing the signal with this number of components. And that's really all the algorithm is attempting to do. It's just trying to compress the representation, compress this the spectrum in a way that allows it to be really efficiently reconstructed. And then you're saying, how many templates are you going to force me to compress the spectrum to? Mm-hmm. It's a little bit by trial and error to set a good number of templates, and it's not something that we have tested systematically in the evaluation. We just sort of found numbers of sound, rhythm, and loop templates that seemed fine.
Uh-huh.
But we would like to test that in the future to be able to pick them in a more principled way.
I notice in the paper you mention at some points you're evaluating against a ground truth. You have something that you expect the factorization tensor to look like, and you're like taking metrics to try to evaluate how well the separation is going. Mm-hmm. It's interesting thinking of what does a ground truth mean in this context, right? And how do you know when you've matched it? Not only how do you choose the right number of loops and rhythms and sounds, but what are you aiming for? Like, what's the target?
There's a couple questions that are entangled here. Yeah, so one of the things that was exciting about this for the ICAST paper was that we were doing two problems at once. We were doing a source separation of the loops, and in the process of doing that, coming up with a map of where those loops occurred in the piece. So it was both source separation and structure analysis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You could argue that depending on which of those tasks is more important to get perfect, you might want to change the parameters a little bit.
Yeah.
If your goal is to get really excellently separated loops that sound really good in a remix interface, you might do it one way. And if your goal is to come up with an excellent map of the piece that faithfully explains what sources seem to occur when, that might need a different optimization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's not possible to optimize for both at the same time.
And maybe that balance would be different for different types of music in terms of how important that structure is.
Oh, definitely.
Right.
You know, we all like to malign house music as just being the same thing over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of interesting when you put the music into this algorithm and see what you get out.
Yeah.
You realize, oh no, there's all this through composition happening in the filters that are applied so that the kick drum during the verse sounds a little bit different from the kick drum during the chorus.
Yeah.
And that immediately poses a problem for my algorithm because I'm looking for things that exactly repeat together. And if it's always different, if the kick drum is always different between these two sections, then why have a kick drum model of a bar and then a vocal model of the bar? Why not just have, you know, this is the kick drum plus vocals for the verse and this is the kick drum plus vocals for the chorus?
For sure. That's a really good point.
I just think it does really interesting things as well when you have something, a single parameter that is varying constantly over a long period of time, like, I don't know, some kind of progressive house or progressive trance where you have like a cutoff and a filter that is slowly increasing. And how does it deal with that? And sometimes it'll just take like the low end and then the high end separately or something. It's wild. And if you put in like music you think is really repetitive, you can see things that like, oh, wow, I was wrong. There is more going on here than I expected because of what it is actually choosing to get. Yeah, so analysis tool as well, huh?
Right. And another part of this problem is just that a lot of music is through composed.
Yeah.
And you might think this song has 80 bars, maybe 20 or 30 bars should be enough to cover it, but there could be 50 or 60 unique component things in it, or more than 80. And this algorithm, like if you try to tell the algorithm, oh, take this 80 bar piece and find the 100 unique bar templates or unique bars that best explain it, it will just crash. Like it cannot accept a parameter greater, well, of 80 or greater, because then the degenerate solution is going to be the solution. Meaning, well, clearly you have one bar type that is bar one and a second bar type that is bar two and so on.
Right.
And one of the challenges of the algorithm, and I guess it falls to future work to sort out how to do this, is how to get the algorithm to give up when it needs to. So you could imagine a song with lots of very clearly repeating loops in the background, but then a vocal part that never repeats throughout the whole thing. But if the vocal part is very loud and prominent in the mix, then the algorithm starts to go, oh, well, most of the energy in this is devoted to this vocal part that doesn't repeat. So I'm going to struggle and fail to model it to the extent that I can. How does one force the algorithm to go, no, all this content that never repeats, don't even try. Focus only on the stuff that repeats at least twice or three times.
That is consistent. Yeah.
That's an interesting conception of a loss function. You know, it's a problem in all kinds of things whenever you're trying to see how good a solution is, right? You know, machine learning, the eternal struggle. But specifically, it's a very interesting, I'm just thinking of it now. How would I specify that in code? How would I specify, find the things that can be expressed as repetition and ignore the rest, even if the rest would give you a much higher kind of utility, right?
That's right.
That's a great problem to think about.
Yeah, how do you get something to explain the things that it has a chance of explaining and remain unexplained the things that it can't?
I mostly work in repeated pattern structure, but mostly in symbolic music. And so I'm thinking of that kind of thing all the time. It's so easy if you just look at music as MIDI, as a really data poor kind of points in two-dimensional space. If you're looking for repeated patterns in there, you're going to find tons of them. I mean, you can find anything as a repetition of anything. You have to be really stingy with how much you allow repetition to exist. There's a very fine line you have to walk before, you know, you find everything is repetition of everything and your algorithm becomes useless to any music analyst or whatever. So first of all, I love that this problem is coming up here as well. and that it's just it's something that's hard to even put into words. But when we hear it, when a person hears like, oh, this isn't a pattern, you can't make a pattern out of this, it's one of the many things in music research where humans are good at doing it, and it's very hard to figure out how to even make a program to tell when it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that problem of human listeners being able to tell immediately what is the part of a piece of music that has the information they should pay attention to and what part of the music is ignorable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like to raise the example of Chocolate Rain, a 10-year-old meme, where it's this very catchy, infectious, very repetitive song. And the melody of the verse and the chorus are identical, but as a human listener, you can still catch on to the chorus because it repeats the lyrics. Or does it even repeat the lyrics? I'm not sure. Anyways, it's a very subtle change in information rate, let's say, between the verse and the chorus. Mm-hmm. But
right,
human listeners still catch on.
And mm-hmm. try catching that with signal processing thing that doesn't involve any kind of speech recognition or lyric recognition or that kind of thing, right?
Right. It's so subtle, it would never be above the noise floor of changes in repetition.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
For any hand-coded thing.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks to the fact that we have expectations for how music repeats, and we're very, very sensitive to these particular ways in which music repeats. They don't match up with, you know, information theoretic stuff that you would do on raw audio, right? They're very sophisticated and hard to describe.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're tuned to our interests, which are specific and also malleable. All right, so since we're talking about humans, I want to talk about the interface too. The link is in the show notes. First off, what were like the big decisions that you had to make in order to get this particular design?
A big part of the design was known from the start, and the vision from the start. So the idea that you would drag and drop an audio file, and then a set of tiles would be returned to you in the interface, and that you would click the tiles to start them and stop them. Mm-hmm. And that much is no invention of ours. It's a style of interface that you could see in a lot of other places.
One of the things I like is that you put the sound wave, or the outline of the sound wave, on the actual tiles themselves. Mm. So someone can sort of see, oh, this is the drum track because it's so crunchy. And you can see, oh, this is something that has like one event per cycle because of the way that it's shaped.
And lots of them, you know, the tonality of them you can't see. Mm-hmm. And there's other, the loudness, not necessarily. But it does give you a good enough hint that you can sometimes guess what the content will be even before you click on it. Mm-hmm. And it helps you remember what part of the song you... Well, it helps you just remember the content a bit, too. That was definitely the contribution of Kawasaki-san, the co-author and developer. He built the interface and the back end that allows people to upload things, and then it runs the algorithm on it. The interface went through a few iterations with us collaborating, but that was definitely his idea. After the user study, you know, it was sort of just a usability test to make sure that you get a little outside confirmation that, yes, this is usable, and normal people find it intuitive. It's not just us claiming that it's intuitive and simple. Mm-hmm. And overall, yeah, sort of overall opinion of the users was this is very simple and straightforward and easy to use and fun to use, but you could make it more complicated. You could stand to make it more complicated. And for myself, that's definitely my impression. Like after playing around with it for a while, above all, I long for keyboard controls. Like I'd love to be able to trigger boxes without having to move the mouse. And you can imagine all sorts of color coding options. But anything that we did in that sense, there's a lot of possibilities, but they all mostly depend on estimating something about the loop. Does this sound like a loop that has drums in it? Or does it sound like a loop that has bass or melody in it? And then maybe color coding it based on that. That's a really appealing option, but it's a whole other problem. Maybe it's a simple problem, but it's a whole other problem to automatically describe the content and try to have that be part of the interface. But we definitely thought about it.
Yeah, a question I had when I was playing around with it was like, what is the order that these things are in?
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah, because I kept on trying to, like, wanting to switch between things, but they're too far apart to trigger. And so I'd have to, like I couldn't get things to go back and forth because they were far away from each other. And then I'm like, well, these two sound really similar. Like, one is the vocals, the other is a harmony of it. And I want to be able to turn them both off, but I can't because they're so far away from each other. And right. So there's those kinds of things that, like, that changes what I can do within this. But then also there's this download function that allows us to get the samples themselves or the deconstructed components, which we could, you know, play with on some other interface if I guess we wanted to continue to fuss around with these things.
Yeah, exactly. The download option is there because we imagine there's at least two potential audiences. One, mm-hmm. the casual user who's curious about this cool toy and wants to play around with it within the browser. Yeah, and the other user that we have in mind is the sort of advanced technical user who perhaps might really want to use these samples in a mashup or a remix like I was longing to do 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they can download the samples. And then there's any number of tools that they could use to further refine the samples. Like you can use equalization mm-hmm. to quiet down the vocal in a sample that you think is mostly percussion content and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As far as which samples we show to the user, that was something that we were changing up to the last minute. It used to be that we were, you know, estimating the layout of the piece. And then we would take the loudest 10 samples and show it to the user.
Hmm.
but then over time, I think I found that the loudest ones tended to be very samey. You know, you get like four loud versions of the same content.
Yeah.
So instead, what we've done now is we've sorted them. We sort the loops according to how common they are.
Hmm.
So and then it's a inverse order of that. So the leftmost one is always the most common loop. That's why the leftmost one is very likely to be a kick drum.
Yeah.
Four on the floor
right.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which actually turns out to be nice too, because it sets up a little bit of parallelism between the lines for each song. Because mm-hmm. the left two or three tend to be percussion and then the right ones effects and melody mm-hmm. and everything else.
Do you mind if I play around a little with an unmixed song that I loaded earlier to just illustrate
sure.
this a little bit?
Go for it.
So this is the unmixing of I Never Felt So Good by Muramasa. Okay. So this is, I think, the most confusing track for me is that by itself, that loop got separated out. And it's very quiet. And that's all it is. And then there's another one that kind of has this has this like shape that's relatively smooth. This is very obviously the kick, that's the drum set, and that's really reliable. But then you end up getting like I appreciate that you're pulling out things that are somewhat different from each other, because then it is possible to get these different patches. The fact that there are these like really isolated, simplified moments, as well as the like larger mixture of things that basically could only have been like ends of phrases, and yet they're still being pulled out as being mm-hmm. distinctive, even though they're obviously like not the loudest and not the most frequent. I mean, I think that like you sample maybe happens twice, but that was enough to come through that very first quiet sample that I played, which I think is really cool. I think it is capturing these sort of iconic components of this music while not being too biased towards the overwhelming elements.
You're reminding me that was one of the problems, it seemed, when we were focusing on loudness. If one of the samples, if, you know, it's attempting to reconstruct 90% of the song, you know, any given component to that might have a limited amount of energy. But then if it says, oh, well, I really don't know how to explain bar 71, except that is its own thing and it uses all its own sounds and rhythms, it might be very loud. And so those one-off ones can be very loud and you're not getting a good separation. So that was another aspect to sorting by frequency.
See, I'm actually surprised that it's by frequency, because given the presence of things that happen relatively uncommonly, which I experienced a lot just playing with it, like Finn said, that you sampled, or, you know, stuff that just happens at the end of a bar, end of a verse every once in a while, I thought it was something to do with loudness or with uniqueness over repetition. And it is kind of surprising to hear that it shows them based on how much they repeat, because it doesn't feel like it when you're playing with it. It doesn't feel like it's always the most common ones. Okay. It feels like there's such a variety in there often, that if you told me that, oh, I'm going to change it so that it repeats, I would expect it to be much more like, oh, well, this one has the snare and this one has the kick and this one has the hat. Be a lot more boring almost. It's really interesting that it picks up on this huge variation of things with that. I mean, that's just one. I imagine pretty much any metric you can throw at it is going to do something we don't expect, because it's operating on a totally different level, right? Yeah, yeah. Which is one thing I was thinking about. Like, I might be the minority of people users, but like, oh my gosh, maybe I'll find the code if I have a free hour in the next 6 months. But to just see different parameters for the actual decomposition itself, different parameters for looking at what loops are put out. You know, if I factor this song with twice as many loop templates, you know, how will it react? That's something that I've been wondering about quite a bit, just because it seems to perform in these unexpected ways that are so interesting.
And it was very tricky, because you could change the number of loop templates that it would estimate. So are you going to try and explain the song in terms of 5 unique loops or 10 unique loops or 20 unique loops? For Unmixer, the way we do it is we start with 30, and then we use that technique described in the paper to try to compress the representation and increase the variety of loops. We compress it down to 20, and then we show you the most common 10. So in some songs, it works very well, and that seems to be the right number of unique elements to explain the song. But in other songs where there's a lot of, again, through-composed content, it just never seems to gel on an explanation. And you'll have 2 or 3 loops that are active almost the entire piece or for whole long sections of it. And then everything else sort of remains like kind of fuzzy. And maybe the problem is that it didn't converge on an answer. I wonder if that explains the cases you had.
What do you mean by converge on an answer? Do you mean that it's like it gets stuck on a single loop and just like says, okay, loop 72 is this one? Or,
well, because it's taking this 3D spectral cube volume and trying to factorize it and compress it, and it keeps updating its solution so far until one of two things happens. Either it runs out of iterations, you know, it maxes out at 500 iterations. Or because the change in the error has become so low that it's like, well, I've converged on an answer.
Oh, so you mean the error just doesn't go down? Like it just can't.
Yeah,
go
so
down.
It works and it fails to improve, so it just says, well, that's your answer. And it might just not be very good.
Right. So it doesn't sound like it has much to do with the song at all.
Except that it is, like, even if that were the explanation of why those particular samples, or at least a couple of those samples, seemed like a curious choices for what I got out for that particular track, they're still interesting. Like, it's not a mistake it doesn't sound like a mistake that it got that particular sample out. It sounds appropriate. Okay. It sounds playful. It's still like a cool thing to play with in terms of samples. So, like, artistically, that totally works. Computationally, maybe it's not operating exactly as intended, but that's fine. I mean, sample finding is a creative, exploratory, oh, wait, maybe this will work kind of a process.
I hypothesize that the interface itself does a lot of the work. I mean, we love hearing stuff repeat. And when I hear a repeating thing on top of a kick drum, it's like,
You trust
it. Yeah, imagine taking a bar of something and putting a kick drum on it and playing it repeat. It's going to sound right. I mean,
yeah,
I think the interface itself, there's a lot to just like, it's going to work.
That's the title of the podcast, right?
So exactly, strangely.
Exactly.
You say so strangely the same way and you loop it oh, wow. It all sounds musical.
What does this tell us about music?
Well, one of the things, and we mentioned it before, was in trying different songs and seeing the failure, the quote-unquote failure of the algorithm to separate loops that sounded different, made me reflect and realize, oh, wait, it's because there are different versions of these sounds for the different sections of the song. And there's a lot more through composition, not even just of the like frequency sweeps and filtering parameters, but they really do use different percussion sounds for the different sections. If you end up with a sample and you go, oh, this only occurred a couple times, but hey, I'm glad that you gave me this. Like the failure mode of the algorithm is such that you will at least get 10 different measures of the original audio. And it may not have done much work at all separating the sources within those bars, but at least you have 10 different bars. And Unmixer is a lot of overkill to get to that point, but the downbeat tracking that it uses is definitely good and puts you on a good footing.
And it does do separation. I mean, there is a substantial amount of distinction that's happening. Even having like better than hand filtered, you know, like drum components and bass ranges, and that shouldn't be sneezed at. It is performing well for certain kinds of music. Yeah.
I think one really interesting thing we could take from that, that it seems to be performing well, is that even when it doesn't separate perfectly, it still seems to be separating musically. Like when you said you had piano and it was separating the bottom from the top, like that's the same source, but I think we can say that there's something in the assumptions that this algorithm is making about how music works that bear out to be successful. Like the assumption of like the sparsity constraints that are being used to kind of enforce loops being made of as few sounds as possible, that kind of thing. That kind of assumption turns out to be useful in how we think about music. And also this, just the assumption that music can be decomposed into these loops at all, even when it doesn't work perfectly, like the structure is there that is so strong, we just connect with that. We have a connection to representing music in this kind of way. And that's really one of the things I like most about this paper is it uses these assumptions that feel so nice. It makes assumptions about music and they feel very nice and they bear out. I think that's what we can learn about music from just looking at what works and what doesn't there. Yeah.
And in all the conversations about like, oh, what is music? What's the definition of music? Is it melody, rhythm, timbre? That is my favorite and main assumption to make, that music is periodic, that it has periodic repetition in it. At some time scale, with some level of fuzziness, sure. But if there's nothing repeating in it, then that is the fastest way to just disengage me.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that kind of assumption is really useful in music information retrieval. It's not perfect. I mean, it's not perfectly universal, but it's a very good blanket statement you can make about what is music. It turns out to be very helpful in a lot of cases, just practical, I think.
To get the representation that works best for a computer, or you're using the repetition to reduce it to the sort of components that would be efficiently described, but we don't want that efficiency. That efficiency isn't useful for us in the way that we engage with music. And so it's great that while you're using that to make a dense representation of these sounds, we're then getting it back in a form that allows us to build this repetition in this cycle and play around and reimpose the cyclical qualities that were used to take it out. I mean, it's lovely how it goes in to be reduced and then spat back out for us to, you know, make as repetitive as we want.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like how you put that we analyzed it by reducing it and removing that which makes it music to us. Mm-hmm. And that analysis lets us kind of rebuild it from the ground up. I mean, it's, you see that kind of impetus in a lot of, I don't know, like music theory, or, you know, like your Shakarian mm-hmm. analysis, or your GTTM, where people are like, they want to describe music as kind of a kernel. They want to describe music mm-hmm. as a little thing that you're like a kind of core, a little object that you're doing operations to and repeating. In like doing stuff from a master's thesis, I had to read some music theory, which I'm not a music theorist by any means, but it was suggested to me that I look at how people have thought about patterns, and this idea of a work being composed of repetitions of a basic idea shows up all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's usually kind of approached sideways, like not said directly, but like people kind of touch on it, like everybody has this kind of understanding that this kind of repetition is interesting, and it's cool that it continues to bear out.
It's very interesting that you say that, because even though Shankarian analysis may have lots of cultural presumptions in it,
absolutely, mm-hmm.
I think the core idea is correct. Music can be compressed.
Yes.
And maybe that's not the most important thing about it. Maybe the way the compression happens isn't important. It's not important that a musical idea or a motive gets elaborated in this particular way, in this particular structure. But I think that is what it is about music that is so much fun. It consists of sound events, and they set up expectations, and these expectations are realized or not. And another way of saying that is, you know, a pattern is being established, and the pattern can either be consistently compressed, or there's a new bit that's introduced and you can't compress it mm-hmm. Beyond that. Mm-hmm. And there's a paper by Jürgen Schmidhuber with a comically long title. The title is Driven by Compression Progress. A simple principle explains essential aspects of subjective beauty, novelty, surprise, interestingness, attention, curiosity, creativity, art, science, music, jokes. And that's it. There's no and jokes.
Oh, it's on jokes? Okay, yeah. Great. That sounds exactly up my alley. Thank you.
Amazing. And I would add puzzles. One of my favorite hobbies is these puzzle hunts, where this is explicitly the point of this style of puzzle, where basically their puzzles and puzzle hunts depend on being presented some information, and then the solver has to figure out the correct way to interpret it. The correct way to look at this piece of paper that's got all these numbers on it that makes a concise answer pop out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
How to find the kernel, yeah.
And there's any number of ways that you could maybe approach the puzzle, but you know you have found the correct way to approach it when all the elements snap into place, or you've compressed the information of the puzzle in a surprising and exciting way.
Mm-hmm. What you're describing and bringing it to puzzles, I think, is a really good way to point out how important repetition is for making music playful. And that game-like reward that comes from understanding and predicting and getting something that it continues to be engaging as it comes back, maybe with variations that we notice or don't notice. So this kind of project, this kind of research, and these kinds of outputs through the process of making a website that people can engage in and upload things to and explore with is a great way of making that playful, of making this kind of research and analysis something that people can enjoy interactively. The rewards are so tangible mm-hmm. in an interface like this. So I think it's fantastic that you've not only gone through the process of getting very respectable source separation standards for a type of music that is incredibly popular, but you've also then made it accessible and enjoyable for people in this kind of setup. So wow. So yeah, I'm really happy you were able to join us today to talk about this research. And Tim, thank you so much for suggesting this paper and this work. This has been really fun.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun to come on and talk about it.
let me encourage your listeners, please check out the Unmixer site. It's so cool. I mean, so fun. Like, if you have a couple MP3s lying around, it's just, it's addictive. It's addictive. And I'm going to certainly keep doing it. I won't stop telling my friends about it. But yeah, it's been great. And I look forward to see where this stuff goes.
Your listeners at home can't see this, but I'm beaming from this review. And it really cheers me that you guys have been enjoying this. So thank you.
So that's it for this episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. If you like what you heard and you want to support the podcast, consider reviewing it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening and recommending and sharing new episodes like this or maybe old favorites. And if you want to get in touch with the podcast, we're on Twitter at So Strangely Pod and also on Facebook and the website, of course, sostrangely.com. And if you're a music science researcher and you have your hands on a new publication or project that you think people should hear about, get in touch so we can make that happen. So drop a line through the contact form at sostrangely.com/contact or email me directly at finn@sostrangely.com. Thank you for listening. And until next time, keep digging into how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.